I just want to think about one parable, a parable that Jesus told, of course. It's only in one gospel, Luke chapter 10, and it's very well known, of course, known as the parable of the Good Samaritan. I suggest you could, if you could find it in your Bible, that would be good because, well, we'll read the parable, but at times, I'd also like us to look at neighboring verses as well. It's a tricky road, the road from between Jerusalem and Jericho. The original route that people would have walked to go from between Jerusalem and Jericho is still fairly clear, and people still walk it today. And that's a photograph of it. And you can see how rocky it is. This was not like a stroll in the country, walking between Jerusalem and Jericho, rocky and dangerous terrain. So I'd like us to read the parable of the Good Samaritan. The text is on your screen, together with a photograph or two. So there's a bit of background before Jesus actually tells the parable. So a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says to him, "What is written in the law? How do you read it?" And the lawyer answers, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." He was quite smart, this lawyer, because that's not just a straight quote from the Old Testament. The first part of it, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart," and so on, is taken from Deuteronomy chapter 6, and that would have been a very well-known passage to all Jews. But "love your neighbor as yourself" comes from the middle of a much more obscure passage in Leviticus 19. And for the lawyer to have put those two passages together shows a remarkable understanding in a way. Anyway, Jesus says to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live." But he, the lawyer, desiring to justify himself, it says, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Now I can imagine that was a much discussed topic amongst lawyers in Israel, because of course it has all sorts of implications, doesn't it? If you say your neighbor is the person who lives either side of you in their house, that's one thing. If your neighbor is all Jews, that's something else. But if all of a sudden your neighbor encompasses the whole of humanity, then that changes everything, doesn't it? So this is a significant question that the lawyer is asking Jesus. I can imagine he was just putting the finishing touches to a PhD thesis on this subject. And so he wanted to see what Jesus would say. Put him to the test, it says in the first verse. So here's the story that Jesus tells. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. It's a journey of about 18 miles, and a drop from Jerusalem to Jericho of around 3,500 feet. So that's like walking down Snowdon. Snowdon's just over 3,500 feet. So walking from the top of Snowdon down to the sea in North Wales. And it's barren, difficult land. Christine and I have done the journey by car, in a hire car that we picked up from Jerusalem and drove down to Jericho. And even in a car, it's on a tarmac road these days, of course, but even in a car, it's still a desolate wilderness. I remember seeing a Bedouin shepherd dressed all in black with a little herd of or flock of sheep and goats following him. But there was very little life. It was just a road going through a barren, stony wilderness. And in those days, it was dangerous. So he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. And I can imagine that's a pretty realistic photograph. Robbed of his goods, of his clothes, left without anything. They beat him and departed. You can see them running off in the distance, leaving him half dead. As good as dead, of course, because in that terrain, there's nobody to help him. He'd have no water, no food left, nobody to help him. Might survive a day or two, perhaps, but as good as dead. But help is on its way. A priest comes by chance. A priest was going down that road. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Now, the other side sounds as though there was a neat path, which, of course, there wasn't. And this is just a trodden path through, as you can see there, a barren, stony landscape. The NLT says he crossed to the other side of the road and passed by. And that, again, that gives the impression of tarmac and white lines, but not like that at all. I think Luke is telling us that he passed as far away as possible. He didn't want to be anywhere near this dying man, presumably in case he came into the same danger himself, or in case he became unclean through touching a dead body. Except priests were there to help people. That was their job. They were there to help sinners, to offer sacrifices for their sins. They were there, in the case of diseases, to diagnose and to prescribe and to certify when somebody was healed. So the priest is backing away from his job in order to protect himself. But we're not finished yet. There's a Levite. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, he passed by on the other side. So our poor dying man is left without any help at all. Levites were a tribe of Jews, and here is a dying Jew by the side of the road. And yet he too passes by on the other side. And then a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. Now, you know about the Samaritans. When the Assyrians took the northern kingdom off to Assyria about 700 and odd BC, that left barren land, and so he brought Sennacherib, presumably, I'm not sure. He brought people from the north and the east and resettled them in the towns of Samaria to replace the people of Israel. And we read in the Book of Kings that they worshipped the Lord and followed their own gods. So you can sort of understand that the Jews would look down on the Samaritans. Oh, they're not proper Jews. They don't really worship God, the Jews would say. They felt they were superior, and so they had no dealings with the Samaritans, we read. And our dying man, if he hadn't been dying, would have had nothing at all to do with this Samaritan. Jesus is giving us a deliberate contrast, isn't he? A deliberate contrast between two ways of life and showing us what really matters. He said to the Jews, "You tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith." And here was a Samaritan demonstrating justice and mercy and faith, while the Jews had passed by on the other side and ignored him. And the Samaritan went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Now, you might think that sounds a funny thing to do, pouring on oil and wine, but that was the medication of the day. They didn't have antibiotics and all the medications that we have these days, but good. Oil would have provided physical protection and softening, and the wine would have provided a soupçon of antiseptic. There's a pharmacist in the room, so I need to be careful. Is that does that make sense, Ruth? Yeah. So these things would have helped healing, the oil and the wine. And then he set him on his own animal. You can hardly see, but there's the man on the donkey there. Set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back. A denarius was a day's wages for a working man. So I investigated how much a plumber would expect to earn these days around here. And plumbers would expect to earn about £60 an hour. So 2 days' work, about £900, is what he was giving the innkeeper. And an open check. Take care of him. And whatever more you spend, the Samaritan says, I will repay you when I come back. And with that, the Samaritan disappears from the story. And we don't hear any more of him except to know that one day he's going to come back. And then Jesus says to the lawyer, which of these three do you think proves to be a neighbour to the man who fell among the robbers? And the lawyer has no choice. The one who showed him mercy, he says. And Jesus says to him, you go and do likewise. And that's a challenging thing to say to the lawyer, isn't it? Because all of a sudden, Jesus has demonstrated that neighbours are not anything to do with proximity or nationality. Being a neighbour is about helping anyone who needs it. And so the lawyer would have had to have gone home and tear up his PhD thesis and start all over again. Now, you're probably wondering to yourself, I thought this talk was supposed to be about the gospel for you and me. Well, it is. just have a think. If you've got the text of Luke chapter 10 in front of you, have a look. Just have a look at the English words and tell me what is different about this parable from all the other parables that Jesus told. And I don't know, there's 40-odd parables that Jesus told, and this one is different. There's something special about it. It's just a fact. It's not an opinion. There's a fact about this parable that's different. There's something in this parable that is not in any other parable that Jesus told. Shall I tell you? It's got place names in. Jerusalem and Jericho. Now, Jesus told a lot of parables about places, didn't he? You know, the prodigal son. The son takes all his money and goes off into a far country. Parable about a nobleman who goes into a far country to receive a kingdom. Or there's a sower who goes to sow. Jesus doesn't tell us where his field is because it doesn't matter. Could be any old field. Doesn't matter. But here, Jesus tells us 2 place names. And surely that means that these place names matter, that they're significant, they're part of the story. And when we look at this parable a bit more, you discover that actually, when you lift the surface, there's another parable underneath. A parable that's not at all an exhortation to us about being nice to our neighbours. It's a parable about something different. It's a tale of two cities. Let's start with Jerusalem. Jerusalem at the time, a bustling metropolis, dominated by the fabulous temple that was being built there by Herod. Years and years it had been building, and still not finished, but a busy place with people coming and going all the time. Ah, shouldn't have shown you that. Tell me the first thing that happens in Luke's gospel. So it's located. That's right, yes. So Zechariah is in the temple in Jerusalem. So the Gospel of Luke begins in the temple in Jerusalem with an angel appearing to Zechariah and telling him that his wife is going to have a son. So there's the beginning of Luke's Gospel. What about the end, the very end of Luke's Gospel? What's the last couple of verses? Anybody remember?
The great commission of them being go out into the
No, that's in Mark. Yes. So here's the last two verses. Yeah. The disciples worshipped. This is Jesus has ascended to heaven as he's going. The disciples worshipped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy and were continually in the temple blessing God. So Luke's gospel is bookended by things happening in the temple. When you think about the life of Jesus, so after Jesus' birth, what's the first thing that happens in Luke's gospel? He's taken into the temple in Jerusalem and meets Simeon and Anna there, you remember. So first thing in Jesus' life, in Luke's gospel, taken into the temple. They brought him up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. So Mary is bringing Jesus and showing him to his father. I guess a lot of mothers who've just given birth, first thing they want to do is to share this birth with the child's father. And that's what Mary wanted to do. They brought Jesus up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. Next event in Jesus' life? Twelve years later, he disappears. And they find him in the temple again. In Luke chapter 4, interspersed with all of these, it keeps saying Nazareth, Nazareth. They went from Nazareth. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus is in Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And he goes into the synagogue. And you may remember that the people in Nazareth are upset by his teaching and they want to throw him down over the cliff. We went to Nazareth. It's an enormous cliff. If you drive along the road at the bottom, it's a really steep precipice with Nazareth just over the top there. He came to Nazareth where he had been brought up and the people want to throw him down over the cliff, but he goes through the crowd and escapes and he leaves Nazareth and he never goes back in Luke's gospel. He starts on the journey of his life and the journey takes him to Jerusalem. He doesn't go to he never visits Jerusalem in Luke's gospel until chapter 19, where he finally makes it to Jerusalem. And then he doesn't leave Jerusalem until after his crucifixion when he ascends to heaven. So the whole of Jesus' life is made up of journeys to Jerusalem. So that's city number one. City number two is Jericho. What's the major event in the life of the city of Jericho? There's a bit of a clue in the photograph. So when Israel entered the land, were about to enter the land, there's a barrier ahead of them. This vast, enormous, reinforced city of Jericho with its double walls standing in their way. A barrier to them reaching the promised land. And you know the story of how the walls fell down. And Joshua and Israel completely destroyed everything in it with their swords, men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep, goats and donkeys, everything. Everything died. So Jericho is a symbol of destruction, of death and of curse, because Joshua invoked this curse. May the curse of the Lord fall on anyone who tries to rebuild the town of Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son, he will lay its foundation. At the cost of his youngest son, he will set up its gates. And so there is a city called Jericho. There still is, but it's a different place. So this map has got Old Testament Jericho there and New Testament Jericho there. And so if you go to Jericho today, that's where you go. And nearby are the remains of the fallen walls and of homes still left with burnt grain from the barley harvest when Israel invaded the place. And so the symbolism of these two places, there's Jerusalem, central to Luke and his gospel, the home of God where people went to worship, and there's Jericho, a symbol of curse and death and of desolation. And our man is going from Jerusalem to Jericho, from the house of God to a place of curse and death. And the thing is, you see, it's a journey that we all make, you and me. It's the journey of our lives. I know it's a rather depressing view, but actually, every day of our lives is a day closer to dying. but the thing about this is, you see, that death is a curse. It's the curse of this world. And even worse than that, death makes life pointless, because it doesn't matter what you achieve in your life, how much you do. It doesn't matter how clever you are, how rich you are. It doesn't even matter how much good you do. If death is the end, then what was the point? You needn't have bothered, because everything dies with you. And you might say, OK, well, the people who you help will live on. Well, yes, but they'll die too. So what was the point of it all? So Jericho is a symbol of hopelessness, pointlessness. And those are the thieves of our lives. Our man fell among thieves, but we have less tangible robbers. Let no one say when he is tempted, "I'm being tempted by God," for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. Therefore, as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, so death passed, spread to all men, because all sinned. This was separate from preparing this talk, but I asked ChatGPT, what forces are the strongest influences in today's society? Do they act responsibly? Fairly unbiased question, I hope. You know, what is it that changes people's opinions most in our world today? And how much can we trust them? How responsible are they? And ChatGPT came up with a list of six influences. The strongest one, these are ChatGPT words, not mine. The strongest one was technology and digital platforms. That really means social media and artificial intelligence. Social media, it says, is driven by algorithms. So if you express an interest in a subject, you'll get more and more posts on that subject that say the same as you already think. So it will encourage you in what you think. And if there are things that make you angry and you respond to it, then you'll get more and more posts on that subject. And so these things accelerate opinion and tribalism, ChatGPT says. Artificial intelligence influences decision making. Second on the list, economic and market forces. That means money to you and me. And ChatGPT says consumerism shapes values. Worth is tied to productivity, wealth, and image. In other words, if you want to know how valuable something is, how useful, how much you should treasure it, well, you work out its cost, its financial value, and that's how you measure it. And so consumerism shapes values, ChatGPT says. Third on the list, political power and ideology. Politicians to you and me. Decision-making, it says, is often driven by polls, optics, or tribal loyalty. And you can see that, can't you, in the politics of today. Whenever there's an issue, you know perfectly well what the Conservatives are going to say and what Labour are going to say, or what Reform are going to say, or what the left wing of the Labour Party are going to say. Decision-making is driven by polls, optics, or tribal loyalty. Fourth on the list, media and narrative formers. That's like newspapers and the BBC. And even there, you'd think BBC was unbiased, wouldn't you? Well, it isn't. Speed and monetization often trump accuracy and nuance. I once flew to America and sat next to Penny somebody or other, who was a reporter, worked for Reuters, who were at the time presenting breakfast news on ITV. And in my memory, she spent the entire journey complaining about corruption in the news media, basing stories on what would attract a big audience, you know, what would be interesting, rather than anything that had a moral lesson. ChatGPT says speed and monetization often trump accuracy and nuance. Fifth on the list, cultural institutions. That's like schools and universities. What you learn at school, ChatGPT says, increasing ideological homogeneity. That means you have to teach what is acceptable in society these days. So you're not allowed to teach that God created the world, or that men and women are supposed to be fundamentally different. Increasing ideological homogeneity limits genuine inquiry in some contexts. And sixth, finally, religion and moral traditions. And of those things, ChatGPT said, a weakened voice, but one of the few forces explicitly concerned with moral responsibility. So you have to get to number six to find anything with any stable values, anything that's really going to teach you anything of any lasting worth. And ChatGPT had a summary. The strongest forces shaping society are the least stable and the least morally accountable. Technology has power without wisdom. Markets have efficiency without ethics. Politics has authority without trust. Media has influence without restraint. Just look at those things that are missing in our world. Wisdom, ethics, trust, and restraint. Now, those things don't creep up behind you on a dangerous walk and steal all your money. In a way, they do something even more important. They steal your values. This man fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. And there were those who ought to have helped him. The priests and the Levites ought to have helped him. But the trouble is, they're going down the same road. Like our dying man, they are going from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And in their way, they are powerless to help. You will not delight in sacrifices, or I would give it. You will not be pleased with a burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. And that was something that neither the priest nor the Levite was able to offer. So where is he going to help? Where is he going to find help, our dying man? Well, he's going to find it from a Samaritan. What direction is Samaria in on that map? North, yeah. This man came from Samaria. That's why he's called a Samaritan. And what we know about him is that this is the first leg of his journey, because he ends up by saying, when I return. So he's going to come back this way. Now, actually, it would be unthinkable that a Samaritan would live in Jerusalem. This is not a man who's going from home down to Jericho. This is a man who's going from home to Jerusalem. He's going in the opposite direction. He lives in Samaria. And Jesus is making a deliberate parallel with himself. Just, if you've got your Bible open, just look back in chapter 9. I don't know whether you've got the same headings as I have. Above verse 51 of chapter 9, a Samaritan village rejects Jesus, it says. So, verse 51, when the days drew near for Jesus to be taken up, so the time of his death is approaching, and Jesus set his face to go to Jerusalem. As I've said, he's never been to Jerusalem previously in Luke's gospel. He sent messengers ahead of him who went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make preparations for him, but the people did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. And so the people in this Samaritan village would have nothing to do with Jesus because he was going to Jerusalem. So here too is Jesus' route. He is going from Samaria to Jerusalem. Okay, so chapter 10, the parable of the Good Samaritan. And then, we didn't read verse 38, but look at it. As they went on their way, Jesus entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. Where did Martha live? Bethany. And Bethany is right by Jerusalem. So, in the context of this story, Jesus is travelling from Jericho to Jerusalem, just like the Samaritan. And clearly, Jesus wants us to look at the Samaritan in this parable and see Jesus there. A Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was. And when he saw him, he had compassion. And I love that phrase. A Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was. The priest and the Levite went as far away as possible, didn't want to go anywhere near this dying man. The Samaritan comes to where he is. And when he saw him, he had compassion. And that's what Jesus did. We just sang, didn't we? Someone like me. someone like me. Since the children have flesh and blood, we read in Hebrews, he too shared in their humanity, you and me. He shares our humanity. He knows what it's like to be you. He knows what it's like to be me. He knows about my faults and my temptations because he has the same temptations himself. So that by death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil. For this reason he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God. The Samaritan has got a donkey. And that means the Samaritan is able to help. The priest and the Levite, with the best will in the world, they might have poured in oil and left the dying man there because there was nothing. The Samaritan, and he his donkey and takes him to an inn. Jesus is able to save. He's able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him. Why? Because he's alive. Because he always lives to make intercession for them. And so the man brings the sick man, the Samaritan brings the sick man to the innkeeper. Take care of him, and whenever, whatever more you spend, I will repay you. When I come back, he says. And Luke uses a unique word. It's not anywhere else in the Bible, except in Luke's gospel, and Luke uses it twice. Here's the first place, when I come back. And the second place is in chapter 19. As they heard these things, Jesus, he proceeded to tell a parable because he was near to Jerusalem. So Luke plays games with us, if I'm honest. He includes place names when he wants to and omits them when he wants to. But in Luke, Jesus is still travelling to Jerusalem, even though four chapters earlier he was already at Bethany. In Luke didn't say Bethany. Now he's near to Jerusalem, and they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. And Jesus tells this parable. A nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and then return. And Jesus describes how the nobleman gives his wealth to 10 of his servants and asks them to use this wealth until he comes back. And then verse 14, 15, when he returned, that's the word. That's this word that only Luke uses, and the only other place is in the parable of the Good Samaritan. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know what they had gained. So Luke is telling us that the parable of the Good Samaritan talks about Jesus leaving and returning to the earth. And he leaves the man in the protection of an innkeeper during that time. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Just think about the dying man raised from his imminent death and taken to a place of safety. He has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled and unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. These words are telling us that those who believe, those who've been baptized, those who have been born again, are being looked after, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. So this parable of the Good Samaritan, well, it exhorts us to be nice to people. Anybody that we meet, anybody who needs help, irrespective of their nationality, irrespective of where they live, we should, as far as we're able, help anyone who needs it. But underneath the surface of that parable, there's another parable, an account of the life and the mission of the Lord Jesus. It tells us of our need and the need of all the world, not just you and me, but all of us. We're sinners. We can't save ourselves. Jesus was born sharing our humanity. He came where we were. He overcame sin and death and has power to save us. And when we're converted, we're looked after and cared for. We're cared for by God, and we share with our brothers and sisters. Jesus asks us to follow in his example, because one day he will return to rule the world and fill it with peace.